Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, so let's get into the week in review. Top story this week, local elections.
This was never about me. It was never about Mayor Walsh. It's always been about the people of the city of Boston and their future.
I'm not waiting for an inauguration. We're going to hit the ground running, continue to look at the housing and continue to look at how we can create more housing in our city.
Here is a kid from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And even though I've lived here for 32 years, I'm still not a what we call a townie, can come to Framingham and see opportunity.
Well, I think any government body definitely should reflect the folks that are going to be directly impacted by them. So, yes, having half the council be people of color in general, I think is just reflective of Boston.
Well, you just heard from City Councilor-elect Lydia Edwards, Framingham's first mayor-elect Yvonne Spicer, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson there. So joining us to talk about what happened at the polls on Tuesday night is Michael Curry. He's former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and he sits on the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Other Michael, it's good to have you back as well.
Good to be here.
Sorry, I couldn't help it, gentlemen. All right, well, let's start with the Boston mayoral race there. We heard, again, from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who won the vote. He took 65% of the vote to City Councilor Tito Jackson. I mean, Michael Curry, let me just start with you. You were actually with us at WBUR on Tuesday night for special election coverage. You know, what's your overall take? How satisfied were you with how the campaigns went?
Yeah, I thought it was a respectful campaign. I thought as the challenger, Tito needed to raise some critical issues, and he attempted to do that. I think you got to take jabs at the incumbent around what he or she has not done. And in this case, I thought he tried to do that. I thought the challenge he always had was the uphill battle of trying to reach the electorate with his message. And this is a tough city, right? The easier campaign is the incumbent because you have all those opportunities to share your vision and to share what you've accomplished. And the challenger has an uphill battle. So I thought Tito fought that as best he could. And he turned out communities that may not have shown up, but for his being a candidate.
Michael Jonas, let me ask you about that, because I definitely take the point about the power of the incumbency in a Boston mayor's race. It's like the story of Boston elections here. But at the same time, I mean, some of the things that Councillor Jackson was talking about, namely housing, also one of the most important issues for Boston residents. So why do you think there was sort of that gap there between Jackson's messaging and what the electorate heard?
Well, I think the mayor is seen as someone who's trying to tackle some of those things. Mm-hmm. I don't think people think he's AWOL on it. I think there's also a recognition that some of the problems that are raised on inequality in general and housing affordability are big, broad issues, and in some ways they're beyond the ability of a mayor to have as much influence as people might like. So I think he gets a bit of a pass on some of those.
Right. Well, I mean, so that's a good point, because, you know, we didn't just get here overnight in terms of all these problems, and no one really expects things to be fixed overnight. So let me just turn the question around to both of you. What are the opportunities then that Marty Walsh has now that he's been reelected? He has 65% of the vote. Does he have – what kind of mandate does he have to help us actually move forward significantly with these challenges?
I mean, I think he has a big mandate, as incumbent Boston mayors do. I mean, they always say that they amass a tremendous amount of political capital, and the challenge has always been, or I think in some ways the disappointment sometimes has been, that they squander it and they're too worried about, about alienating constituencies. I mean, certainly I think if we say that, you know, the broad question of economic inequality is maybe beyond the power of a mayor to affect, control of the schools is now fully in the mayor's hands, in Boston particularly, where we have mayoral control of the schools. And I think there are huge challenges there. And I think the mayor's been really tentative so far about taking those on, whether it's, you know, changes and reforms in how the schools operate, to the physical issue of school consolidation,
which
is kind of a third rail issue. Everyone knows it's coming. There was a lot of feeling that it was kind of punted or the can was kicked down the road till after the election. So that's one of many things that he's going to, you know, have to deal with in
Michael
the next
Curry?
Term.
Yeah. Overall, I didn't think it was a good turnout, as we see across the country, and here was no exception. That the turnout in our
less than
30%, and even when you look at communities of color, I think Tito was hurt by the fact that communities of color didn't come out as strong as they could. And less than the neighborhoods like JP and West Roxbury and South Boston, some of the areas where Mayor Walsh did very well. I think part of it is, and again, we've beat this drum many times, it's a tale of two cities, right? That the reality is if you're a police officer, a black police officer, you may have issues with the equity within the Boston Police Department, the opportunities, the promotion, the pipeline of officers. If you're a firefighter of color and you're not seeing a pipeline, there's a lot of things that were not done under this administration. And I think, and we've all said it and we've discussed it, Mayor Walsh is a great guy. We like him. But this is about setting a high bar for the city and making sure that there aren't neighborhoods that feel like they're not represented and that their issues aren't top of mind and that the solutions aren't readily available. And I think that that's the challenge for Mayor Walsh, is that this election woke him up, that people are not happy with some things under his administration, and he has an opportunity to do something.
So is that what you meant when during our special coverage on Tuesday night, you said that do I think voters of color in communities, voters of color in communities really knew what was at stake and what measures to look at in evaluating this mayor? No, you said.
Yeah, it's interesting about elections in general, right? And I think anyone who's ever watched and been in politics knows that the challenge is how do you make the electorate understand what the issues are that are at stake? So if you're an African-American mother in Roxbury and you don't understand economic development and housing and education, you may not know that your grandkids and your kids are getting a bum opportunity in terms of their education compared to other school systems, other neighborhoods, other towns. So you may not know that. And it's the responsibility of organizations and individuals to say, hey, this is where we are and this is where we should be. And unfortunately, the NAACP report card, to credit to the Boston branch, came out pretty late, but it was timely in the sense that it gave voters some opportunity to look at the data in it. But we need to make sure we do that on a timely basis on these next 4 years so that when he runs in 4 years, people are really holding him accountable to the data as to whether he did what he needed to do.
Michael Jonas, what's your thought on that?
I mean, I think one real problem with this, and it kind of gets into the question of how the race was covered. Michael's talking about, you know, whether people really understood what was at stake.
Yeah.
And we did hear a lot during the race, you know, particularly from Tito Jackson, complaints that the race wasn't getting enough coverage. I guess I have, you know, I'm trying not to be too defensive as part of the media. You know, I think some of his points were well taken, but I think there's a little bit of a chicken and egg dynamic at play when, you know, he was so underfunded and so sort of unable to kind of energize a voting base to sort of turn this into a more competitive race. That would have in turn certainly led to more coverage. You know, they argue, again, this chicken and egg thing, that more coverage would have energized people. And we always have that argument. I mean, I think, you know, not to be too much of a sort of Debbie Downer on it, but it's just been the nature of things that Boston mayors, when they're running for re-election, anything other than an open race for mayor, you know, mayors have huge advantages. And we saw Marty Walsh, as Tom Menino did, they do everything they can to sort of downplay the race, to sort of not energize people. They, you know, the mayor did not agree to, you know, a whole set of debates.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think it's, you know, they end up not being really the platform or the forum where we really have a really vigorous, good discussion of the issues, which is, of course, this is when we're supposed to have those. But that's just been the reality. I mean, it's sad to say.
I will just put it on us as the media that maybe next time around we ought to look for more creative ways
to really
energize the conversation. I'll just leave it at that for now.
And make sure that we can reach communities of color. I think part of what we're with mainstream media is that are they penetrating the neighborhoods in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan? I would say you could take polls. I'm not sure how many people are waking up and reading the papers or tuning in. Maybe what we can do going into these next few years is really to go into those communities and broadcast live or
connect,
cover some stories that are more of interest to them. But we don't do it as much as we should.
Right, because we say communities of color, but we're talking about Boston.
Right? Exactly.
So that's the whole point. Well, let's talk about the city council here for a minute if we can, because speaking of diversity, 6 of the 13 seats on the city council are now held by women of color, the other 7 by white men. I mean, this is a really big change for Boston City Council, a welcome one. I'd say, Michael Jonas, what difference do you think it's going to make?
Well, I mean, I think that it will make a big difference, but I think there's a big question mark that remains. The question mark is that the Boston City Council has historically not been a very potent force, provided that great a check. With that said, I think we can sort of, you know, let's be hopeful and think about the idea that this council of a very different makeup, you know, is going to sort of bring some change to that. And I certainly think, you know, I mean, not to single her out, but Lydia Edwards, who I covered a bit when she actually ran last year in a special state Senate election, is a really dynamic person. I mean, she was a community organizer. She was somebody who has real experience sort of pushing issues to the fore that, you know, that people might be uncomfortable with or that the powers that be would just as soon have ignored. So, I mean, that's certainly the kind of profile that you would hope would lead her to be part of a voice on the council to kind of push issues and challenge the administration in a way that the council maybe hasn't.
Yeah. So, Michael Curry, let me ask you about that, because I actually do appreciate that Michael Jonas brought up the sort of limited power of the city council. I mean, how much do you think, because the new voice, the diversity of voices is definitely going to be there. We're going to hear from them during city council meetings. We're going to hear from them in terms of the policies that they take up. But if you do run into the sort of limited power in terms of affecting change for the very people that they're representing, isn't that going to forever be a problem here?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's limited power, but there is power. I think about the body camera conversation and the hearings that I attended around the body cameras. It was the city council that led that conversation.
Right, wasn't that Councilor Campbell?
Councilor Campbell pushed the city of Boston around that with the Boston Camera Action Team with Shogun Ito. And I think that that's an example of where they can be very impactful is the bully pulpit. But I also think that the critical part about these six women and what this creates in terms of a pipeline is that the city council is a stepping stone to other opportunities. Mm-hmm. Our next mayor, potentially our mayor of color beyond Mayor Walsh, could be a woman and a person of color out of that group. That's exciting. In the history of this city, we've only had white men. In the history of this city, we've only had the first woman of color was Ayanna. The first Asian American was Michelle Wu.
Yep.
That is ridiculous in a city of this size with that much diversity. That's talent we left on the table all these years. So I think I'm excited because, and particularly Kim Janey is a good friend of mine. She's going to be dynamic in that building. And there's a lot for us to be excited about.
But my turn for reality check, you might have to wait 20 more years given mayors in the city of Boston.
Right.
Let's turn now to Framingham, because actually, in a way, I'm most excited about what's happening in Framingham, because the city of Framingham elected its very first mayor ever there, Yvonne Spicer. She's a current town meeting member, vice president for advocacy and educational partnerships at the Museum of Science. Now, the reason why Framingham hadn't had a mayor before is because it wasn't a city, but they voted to turn themselves into a city. Very tight vote, just 104 votes. And now they have picked Yvonne Spicer as their mayor-elect. Michael Jonas, first of all, what do you think about her as mayor-elect, and what are the immediate challenges that she's got right in front of her?
I mean, I think that, you know, from everything that I know of her, I mean, she's, you know, super impressive. And I think, you know, first and foremost, you know, with all of the sort of taking note of kind of the firsts and barriers that were being broken in her race or Lydia Edwards, I mean, these people are, I think, were really elected because they were, you know, they struck the voters as highly competent. They addressed the issues. So, I think that, you know, it's a credit you could say, or maybe it's long overdue that voters, you know, were voting for the candidate they thought was best, you know, irrespective of race or gender.
Yeah.
But I think that's first and foremost. She seems totally poised to lead the city. I mean, there are differences, you know, when you move to sort of a mayoral system. And so she's going to be now the top manager, which is different than, you know, these communities have for decades or centuries had relied on a professional manager.
I mean, they're building a city government basically from scratch.
Right. And it's sort of like, as they say, fixing the plane as it's in flight. I mean, they've still got to be functioning and moving ahead, but sort of making that transition.
Michael Curry?
And I've had an opportunity over the years that I was president of the NAACP and even some years prior to that to work with prior mayors. I worked quite a bit with Mayor Menino, some with Walsh, a lot with Bill Carpenter and Brockton. From what I know of her and the folks that I know of her, she's going to be powerful for the city. And I think that she has the skill sets and, as Michael said, the talent, the expertise, the professional background that she'll hit the ground running and she'll do very well.
Hmm. All right. Good. Well, so that's kind of a very quick roundup of what happened on election night here in Massachusetts. I want to turn now to another major story this week. This has to do with Berklee College of Music, because the Boston Globe reported this week that several students have reported being assaulted, groped, or pressured into having sex with teachers there. Here's Boston Globe reporter Kay Lazar, who reported on the story, describing one of the allegations.
A Berklee student alleged that one of her professors, who was her mentor, had offered to walk her home from a gathering, a party, because obviously she was had drunk too much, and then she doesn't remember a whole lot more, but woke up the next morning, and she was naked and he was laying next to her and groping her.
Well, and the Globe's report also said that Berkeley allowed three male professors to quietly leave since 2008 after student complaints against them. And, of course, this all comes in the midst of all of these revelations from point to a corner, and revelations are coming out about sexual harassment and assault. So, Michael Curry, let me just start with you. Like, what do you take about what do you make of what's been reported about what's happening at Berkeley?
Yeah, I was appointed by Governor Patrick to serve on RCC's board during some of that tension that was there and some of the allegations that happened at RCC, and it's come a long way. There are laws in place and some regulatory framework that is supposed to address these things on college campuses. So I'm curious to see how that plays out and what Berkeley will do to respond to that. The transparency, the accountability piece is important. You can't just ship people off to be to be victimizers in other places. You gotta notify folks that the person is accused of something, and you gotta provide some notice to the students. And I think that we're dropping the ball on that, not just at Berkeley, across the country, and that there's that protection of the reputation, that competing interest to not damage the reputation of the school, the company, the organization, the industry. We gotta get past that.
Michael Jonas.
Well, I mean, you know, with a lot of these cases nationally, they're kind of, I don't know if the term is one-offs. I mean, they involve an individual and a set of victims. In this case, you know, as Michael is saying, we're talking about an institution, and I couldn't help being here in Boston, but here sort of in this, an echo of the Catholic Church scandal involving priests, because, again, the reflex was to protect Berkeley, to protect the institution. So they were getting these students to, you know, agree to stay quiet, paying settlements. And essentially, you know, while the church moved priests to other churches, they were letting faculty members move, I think one moved just from Berkeley to New England Conservatory.
Yeah.
So
the
parallels
laundry,
were
right?
just sort of eerie and creepy.
So Michael was talking about what some potential responses should be or could be from institutions. Like you said, calling for more transparency,
right.
And letting people know. But so talk to me in a little bit more detail. What exactly would that look like, say, in Berkeley's case?
Yeah, well, I mean, one is there's reporting requirements. So I'd be curious if they were compliant with the reporting requirements that exist. That's one. Two, I think, is really about the culture of the institution, and that's a softer one, but it's one around notifying women to be careful and what to look out for, and maybe even some men as well. And I'm not sure if the school, and again, I think it's not just that school. It's across the country, and most of us who've had college experiences know or have been in companies know that people drink and people do things, and then people end up in these situations. And we just have to be more diligent about preventing these things. And that's an onus we all have, not any one particular person.
Well, we have a little bit more tape here from Boston Globe reporter Kay Lazar on the response that she's got from her story so far. And here's what she said.
Every hour I'm hearing from parents, I'm hearing from students, I'm hearing from faculty and former faculty. Yes. The inbox is overflowing.
And Kay also has told us that they only published the stories they had documentation for, and now they've got a lot more. So, Michael Jonas, I just wanted to have you pick up on what Michael Curry was saying on what should the proper institutional response be.
Well, I mean, I think the things that Mike points out on the institutional side are all necessary and appropriate, but I think there's also, you have to, there's got to be some recognition, I would hope, that what's happening with this media coverage is also an important part. It's not sort of a structural sort of institutional response, but, you know, the whole idea about sunlight and what that can do to things, the fact that we are hopefully pulling back the curtain and we are sort of telling people to come forward with things, that you know, in itself ought to, I think, be part of what the dynamic is going forward, and that you know, people are going to feel more empowered and more able to come forward.
Well, I hope so, because, you know, I'm also thinking of all the reporting about, you know, a culture on Beacon Hill, for example, as well. And to my mind, we can put in sort of structural reporting requirements for transparency, et cetera. But really, you got to affect the culture change,
that's
right?
Everybody keeps
and
saying.
And it seems like that is the toughest nut to crack, right? And the transparency and the willingness to come forward is only the first step to that.
Right. And leadership matters, right? You saw the Speaker of the House, I think the Senate President, both came out with statements and very definitive decisions around what to do going forward. I think we're in that place where we now have to hold leaders accountable to do those things. And the other conversation is around innocent until proven guilty, right? Mm-hmm. We have to wait till this stuff plays out. Now, that's a criminal side, but it's also a public opinion side, too, is to let these things play out. We do know that it is prevalent. We do know that there are many legitimate cases. Let's make sure that we let this play out, but let's hold people accountable in a way that makes sense.
I think that's a really important point to call because, you know, there are some cases where maybe there's somewhat more of a gray area. But I'm thinking back to one of those cases at Berkeley where the professor even sent text messages
Absolutely.
To the student afterwards admitting as to what had happened. And this is the same person who went on to teach at two other local music schools. So
it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be working.
All right. Well, we have I'm going to try and make a turn here to some hopefully more positive news because we have just enough time for our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast this week, but worth a mention nonetheless. So, Michael Jonas, your hubbub?
Well, I will be positive. And,
good.
And I'll start with saying we hear a lot about naysayers. So my hubbub has to do with yaysayers. So this week, organizers announced that Boston next year is going to be host to a national conference of the YIMBY movement, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. They're kind of the counterpoint to NIMBYs, or Not in My Backyard. And this is a national network of groups that works to promote policies to see more housing built in cities at greater density. And it just seems like that'll be a great conversation. We just had municipal elections in Boston and Cambridge where the issue of the dearth of affordable housing was front and center. So we're going to sort of have that, even the national conversation, come to Boston in the fall.
Oh, absolutely. So YIMBYs. Maybe we're going to see T-shirts that say Yes in My Backyard pretty soon as well. Michael Curry?
I think, you know, my hubbub would be an article I saw recently about a mutiny aboard one of the cruise liners, Costa Cruises. And essentially what we're seeing play out in transportation across the board, and particularly with American Airlines and some of the other airlines, people are not happy. And in this case, in a cruise, they changed, I think, three or four of the locations they were planning to go to and canceled the stops. And the passengers mutinied. they protested, banged on tables, and decided that they were upset with the changes. And they were not happy with the 150 euros that the cruise line offered to make them whole. So to me, that's a sign of many more things to come when we have unhappy passengers.
Well, I guess it always helps to keep your passengers as happy as possible, especially when you're on a ship in the middle of the ocean. So my hubbub has to do with the Boston Globe's website and actually the Boston Globe's tech infrastructure. And really, guys, my hat's off to you because they got attacked. They had a distributed denial of service attack over Wednesday and Thursday, essentially hackers took the Boston Globe's website down for several hours yesterday. And you can see, like, this is my hubbub because we rely on the Globe and the Herald and stuff to keep us updated on certain things throughout the day. And if you think that this means that, like, the Globe's is up there with Equifax and stuff, no. I can say that for sure. Maybe sort of the saddest thing about the attack on the Globe is that this kind of internet attack, according to Arbor Networks of Burlington, has already happened this year 7.1 million times, or 23,000 times a day. Some site is hit by a DDoS attack because all it takes is a couple of bucks and someone with some malware on the Internet of Things, and they can take your website down. So Globe, you did a good job getting your site back up, and I appreciate it, but you're one of 7.1 million such attacks this year. That's my hubbub for today. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, thank you so much for joining us. And Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.